Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Think of the difference between birdsong and opera. Both are beautiful, both artful. But where opera is a product of generations of writing and training and staging and performance, the song of a nightingale, say, is untutored, instinctive. And so it is with a category of art, popularly referred to as outsider art. Often the work of an unquiet mind, someone who is schizophrenic, autistic, mentally retarded. Outsider art can also be the product of an untrained artist, an individual who paints or sculpts for the sake of painting and sculpting, someone with no real aspiration to be an artist. 50 years ago, a French collector named Jean Dubuffet gave this kind of art a name. Art Rou, he called it. Raw art. Well, now, critics and collectors are taking another look at the distinction between the raw and the cooked, outsider and insider art. Some argue that the only real distinction is what's good art and bad art. Connection listeners, what do you think? Should art produced by trained and untrained artists be treated differently in the art world? If an artist's studio also happens to be in a mental institution, should that have any kind of bearing on the way that person's art is evaluated? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined today from the studios of National Public Radio in New York City by Roberta Smith. She's an award-winning art critic for The New York Times. Roberta has written extensively on the topic of outsider art. And also joining us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco is John McGregor, noted authority in the history of psychiatric art. He spent more than a decade researching his most recent book, Henry Darger, In the Realms of the Unreal. He's also well known for a book he wrote in 1989 called The Discovery of the Art of the Insane. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
John, I'd like to start with you if I can, because one of the most fascinating things I found in reading about this was that everybody who has studied it and written about it seems to have their own description, their own sense of what outsider art is. Can you give me your sort of simple version of what's in and what's out outsider art?
I can. I differ somewhat from Dubuffet in his definition. My definition tends to focus more on the psychiatric side, and I like to talk about art produced in the context of a massively altered state of consciousness, which frequently is psychosis, but could also theoretically be something like religious mysticism.
So you would take off the table the memory artist like Grandma Moses or the rural sort of completely untutored painters?
Absolutely. Those I would classify as naive artists. And in fact, I don't accept any just untrained artist as being an outsider artist.
Roberta, you've been writing most recently about Adolph Wolfley, whose figures prominently at the American Folk Art Museum in New York, and a show that's underway there now. And one of the things that jumped out at me is that if we go with John's definition of the unquiet mind, the massively altered state, Adolph Wolfley would fit very nicely in as an outsider artist. Fair enough?
To a certain extent, yes.
But, and here's the big but, you say in your writing that his work in a way ends the definition between insider and outsider art. I wanted you to explain that for us.
I don't know quite if I put it that way. I think that the insider-outsider definition is extremely difficult to maintain and patrol. I mean, Wolfley himself was, seems to me, when you read about his life, practically an extremely ambitious, slightly neurotic artist. I mean, I know he was way beyond neurotic, but I think that the art world of the past 30 years, there's been all these definitions that have been breaking down between all kinds of things. And I'm just not interested in making this distinction and sort of either saying that one is uncontaminated or more intense, or one is more professional and more trained. I think, you know, Wolfley was, he executed commissions. He did all, he actually, to contradict a little bit what you said, Wolfley was pretty well known at certain points in his life, and he actually exhibited while he was living, mm-hmm. had commissions from people both inside and outside the institution where he spent all of his working life, certainly. So I just don't think that the distinction holds. There are too many artists with severe mental problems who are never institutionalized, who have viable careers. And Wolfli himself seems to have been fairly conscious and communicative after he'd been institutionalized for a while.
Now, Roberta, there'll be people listening to us who won't know his work. Can you just describe one of his pieces for us? I know that's a tall order given the nature of the art, but...
Oh, wow. well, Wolfli created an entire universe of which he was the center and the emperor, and he kind of generated extensive texts, and he illustrated these texts with densely worked images that were sort of incorporated elements of maps and architecture. They depicted scenes that he knew from life. Mm-hmm. They were influenced by Swiss folk art to some extent, but they had this whole mythological complexity. They incorporated musical scores and had all kinds of strange creatures. A recurring motif was a staring face that was sometimes masked like a bandit, sometimes crowned like a kind of African royalty. Christian myth and figures were obviously involved as well. But what you have is this overwhelming sense of pattern and visual information, all carefully organized, tightly organized, and different, almost conflicting signs and symbols and narratives.
We actually have an image of one of his pieces on our website at theconnection.org if we're whetting your interest for a look at the work of Adolf Wolfli. You can see it there. John McGregor, you were also writing quite recently about a woman called Judith Scott, who
yes.
I thought perhaps might be a useful person to hear about in trying to come to an understanding of how these terminologies or how the definitions are made. Would you say Judith Scott fits your definition of an outsider artist?
It fits my definition, and in fact, you know, I was really the first to publish her and state that I thought she was an outsider, but when I did that, I had no idea whether the world would accept my assumption.
Tell us a bit about her, because her story is just fascinating.
Well, she's still alive. She's probably working right now this morning here in San Francisco area. She's in Creative Growth Arts Center in Oakland. She suffers from Down syndrome profoundly, very profoundly, and she's also totally deaf. And for the last roughly 20 years, she's been making what we call sculpture, which are fiber pieces, things inside them, when then wrapped and sewn with needle and various fibers. And they become very large. Sometimes they're as large as she is. So they take months of work. She works very intensively, 5 days a week for 6 hours a day. And she hasn't a possible notion of what art is. I mean, she's far too retarded for that. So we don't really know what she's doing. I wrote a book to try and think about that, but I'm not sure I succeeded. But the work, strangely enough, after, you know, she was institutionalized for 45 years, and once she came out, she started doing this stuff, and it's found international interest and ridiculous prices.
Now, if she is unaware of the value of what she's producing and unable to talk about that, does it raise any questions in your mind about whether or not she can be or is being exploited?
Oh, she's not being exploited in that she's working in an art center where, you know, a whole lot of people are working together, and she receives, as any artist does, half of the profits from her work. The rest goes back into the art center. Mm-hmm. So in the sense that, you know, she has become famous, it has benefited her in a way. On the other hand, she doesn't know what money is. She's incapable of using it, so it's made a little difference to her lifestyle. She also has no idea about fame, but she enjoys the visits from people, as Wolfli did when people came to see Wolfli.
Roberta, how do you work this sort of definition through? If an artist is unaware that he or she is producing art, does that have any bearing on whether or not we as the viewers ought to consider it art?
Well, we consider all kinds of things art that weren't originally intended as art because they have a certain kind of intensity as objects. And Judith Scott's work certainly has that. And it also has connections to all kinds of contemporary art. I mean, when people look at this work and decide that it is valuable or interesting to consider as art, they're connecting it to things that they know, say the work of an artist like Eva Hesse, who also worked with string to some extent, and they're also considering it as different enough or, quote, original enough from what they already know that it deserves its own attention. So there's the element of how these things resemble other things that are known and become valued for that reason, as well as for their innate expression, that I think is what's important. I think that the story of Judith Scott is fascinating and really touching, but ultimately her objects have to stand on their own, just as we look at objects from the ancient past without knowing anything about the artists who made those works. That her objects are going out in the world and they're having their own effect on people, regardless of the particulars of her biography.
I remember when I was quite small, people would come to our front door selling greeting cards that were painted by mouth painters, and they sold them as a way of, that part of the sales pitch was guilt, you know, you need to help mm-hmm. these people out. And as I was reading about Judith and Adolf and others last night, I was wondering whether or not there's a risk that the praise based on pity bleeds over into an appreciation or an understanding of art produced by someone like Judith.
Well, artist biographies are always involved with our appreciation of their work. I think if that appreciation lasts, it's not because of the biographies. But we have to sort out Picasso's wives from his paintings. So I don't think it's all that different. But that's all I have to say.
No, okay. John, can you give me your thought on that? I know you've been asked about it before.
Well, my concern is with the issue of meaning. I'm not so much concerned with biographies and diagnoses and all that sort of thing, but art has meanings. And the meanings that are associated with these particular artists are often very, very unusual because they're coming out of a mental state which is very, very different from the norm. And in that sense, I think it's very important that we know enough about their thinking, about their mind, to be able to see what it is they're getting at. I mean, in the case of, say, Wolfley's work was all produced as illustrations for his books, with the exception of the so-called bread art. Mm. And those things were cut out of the books and now hang on walls. But they all have associated text with them, very extensive, thousands of pages. And we know more about Wolfley's fantasy world, his deep mind, than we do about most other people. And those thoughts, those ideas are very strange. And I feel that if this art really has value, it's that it's opening to us this other realm, this deeper realm of the mind. Art always does that, but psychotic art does it in very peculiar ways.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Is it time to do away with the distinction of outsider or insider art? Is it necessary to identify those artists who flourish despite whatever odds are against them? 1-800-423-TALK. To join our conversation, I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. This hour we're talking about outsider art and whether the distinction established some 50 years ago is still relevant, still works. My guest this hour, John McGregor, noted historian and scholar of outsider art, Roberta Smith, art critic for The New York Times, and we're going to bring in another guest now. Carrie Schuss joins me on the line from New York City. He owns and runs KS Art. It's a gallery dedicated to the works of outsider artists. Carrie, welcome to The Connection.
Hello.
I'm interested in a young man whose work I've seen a little bit of, in as a perhaps an example of another artist in this category. Can you tell us how you first discovered Jonathan Lerman?
Well, actually, his mother called me, and at first. first I thought the conversation was rather funny because she was calling me about a 10-year-old's artwork. But she was nice, and I agreed to look at the slides. And when I was, as soon as I saw the slides, I was very impressed and very shocked because somehow, and he has severe autism and supposedly like a 70-something IQ, and here he was making these beautiful pictures, and he somehow intuitively knew how to shade a face, and the tonality of the pictures were amazingly sophisticated and interesting.
Was it the sort of skill that we often associate with autism, where one part of the brain seems to have this almost genius, in your view?
Yeah, and Jonathan Lerman is quite unique because most of the time, autistic artists, and not all people with autism are artists, but they tend to deal with geometry and math and straight lines. And here was a young boy who was, you know, telling us a lot very expressively about other people, other people's emotions, and straight on beautiful pictures of faces.
And just a little bit about your definition, if you would, Carrie, because you've also represented Aaron Birnbaum, a fellow whose work, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, but was closer to folk art than John McGregor's definition of outsider art. What's the circle that you draw, and what fits inside outsider art as far as you're concerned?
Well, I don't really draw a circle. I tend to agree with Roberta Smith on this one, and Aaron Birnbaum, who worked until he was 100 and a half, really maybe was kind of the last of the naive painters or folk artists in a way, but he was definitely outside the mainstream art world. And so I kind of tried to stay away from too many categorizations and titles.
Now, in fact, you're trying to mix outside art and inside art in your shows at KS Art, right?
Yeah, mainly I represent outsider artists, but I try to do group shows that blur the distinction between the two. And right now I have a show up called Ballpoint Inklings that was curated by a fellow named Jeffrey Young that really, when you walk in at the gallery, there's everybody from a very famous artist like Elizabeth Murray to someone that a young artist you never heard of to an outsider artist. And people tend to look at the work, not the biography or the title, and evaluate it that way.
Carrie, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Carrie Schuss, owner and actually runs the KS Art. It's a gallery in New York City in Tribeca. 1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation. John McGregor, you obviously know the work of this young Lerman fellow. Does he?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. It's as Carrie described. Lots of portraits. I just happened to be thumbing through a book before the program.
Mm-hmm. My list of outsiders here in America might include perhaps 20 artists.
Right.
That's all. So, you know, I'm sure probably none of them are in his gallery. My definition, you know, I agree very much with Roberta. The issue of quality is very important here.
Right.
I mean, I'm an art historian. My concern is with masterworks.
Now, unless I'm wrong, John, you're also a psychologist because you're listed as both in one of the books I was looking at yesterday, on Wolfley. Is that fair or no?
You can't call me a psychologist. I have training in psychiatry and psychoanalysis, although I'm neither of those creatures. But I've never had any psychological training.
The part about it that interests me, and the reason why I ask you, is that you're looking at the work of the unexplained, or and you're talking about Judith when you write about the possibly unexplainable. And I was left puzzling how you make a distinction between the fascination you have with the way that this art, you know, holds a mirror up to the mind of the creator, and how you then evaluate it in terms of all other art. Do you know what I mean? Because you're saying, in one sense, as Roberta is, it's either good or it's bad, but you are also so fascinated with what it shows us about the nature of the mind of the person who creates it.
Yes, and I focus exclusively on artists of extraordinary ability. But, and I'm talking about, you know, there was once a show of Paul Klee and Adolf Wolfley, and I mean, they're on a par. They're equals as far as creative genius goes.
I totally agree with that.
There, and that's why I say there are very few. And in fact, there, genius among outsiders or among psychotic artists is just as rare as it is among normal people. That is exceedingly rare indeed.
Yeah.
It doesn't turn up very often. Now, I'm sorry, you asked a question that I think I didn't quite get.
No, I was just wondering whether or not your fascination with you know, the work of the disturbed mind doesn't make it kind of difficult for you to then evaluate that piece of art against art in general. Do you know what I mean?
No, I mean, anyone who is making evaluations, first of all, it can only happen when you've had, you know, a lifetime of experience with the fine arts. As an art historian, obviously, I don't exclusively confine my interest to psychotic artists. And so you make your decision based on your own experience, but really that's just a personal decision. And in fact, every decision about a work of art is a personal decision. And ultimately, it's just a question of how long this stuff lasts, you know, whether it continues to have meaning generation after generation. And in the case of Wolfley or of Darger or of Aloise Corbaz, a famous woman psychotic artist, you know, it's been time, it's been artists of great celebrity who saw the work and were dazzled by it. You know, almost all outsider art, the real thing, is discovered by artists in almost every single case.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they know what originality of vision is. They can see when someone's dealing with topics that have never been dealt with before in art or are inventing a language which has never existed in art.
Now, Roberta,
and when that happens, you're dealing with the real thing.
But many of us, and I'm among them, rely on people like Roberta to guide us in terms of what we have to look at. And Roberta, perhaps you can help me with an answer to the same question. When you walk into a gallery that is displaying work by an outside artist, someone of an unquiet mind, if I can use that term, are you able to put that history, put that biography out of your mind and turn your eye to an evaluation of it as art?
That's my job, I would say.
Yeah.
That basically I look at a lot of work that where I know nothing about the artist, insider and outsider. I mean, so you can only start with what you look at. I mean, you know, to say that these artists are mental, there are plenty of artists, as I think Carrie said, who are mentally disturbed, who do not make art or do not make interesting art. And you look at enough of this stuff long enough, as John McGregor says, you know, for a lot of your working life, you start to make distinctions. I'm very interested in John saying that that his list is so short, because to me, that's sort of like me just talking about, you know, Matisse and Picasso and 18 other artists, which seems like you're sort of establishing a whole other canon. You know, there's this huge crowd of artists who are making degrees of outsider art with degrees of quality. It just seems like you're reinforcing a certain very familiar kind of narrowness to it.
John?
Probably true. I have confined myself to a limited number. And one thing that I should say is that the first time you come up against one of these artists, and I've never discovered an outsider artist in my life, but, the first time you see one, my normal reaction is often, no, it's not the real thing I'm looking at. And then I go away and it starts to plague me and I can't stop thinking about it. And it comes into my dreams. And, you know, ultimately I have to go back and look again and think again. Now, other people, I'm sure, make the decision more easily. With Darger, for example, the first time I saw Darger, I was not in doubt. I realized instantly that I was looking at something absolutely extraordinary. With Judith, I thought about her for several years while I was being asked to write a book and saying no, because I simply didn't know where I stood with it. So it's not an easy decision, and it's not usually a quick one.
All right, let's see if we can open this up to some of our callers. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And in Malone, New York, Joe's joining us. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
My comment is that I believe many times someone who has a talent or a vision, who is maybe low income, no education or technical training, because they spend their life in that kind of frustrated lack of expression, no time to devote to their talent, I believe they could become outsider art later on. And I think if the community, both on a national level and local level, if we could nurture found artists or people that obviously have talent, it might keep them from that long slide into psychosis from frustration of lack of expression.
I think it's probably true, isn't it, Roberta, to say that of the people who are, I'm going to say the A-list here of outsider artists, Birnbaum and Wolfley and Darger, they all came to it quite late in life, didn't they?
Well, I'm not so sure John would know better about Wolfley, but he started making art about 8 years after being incarcerated. And I don't think he was in his, what, 30s? Something like that.
Yeah,
I mean, I do think the question of whether some of these artists end up in asylums because their talent has been frustrated is a very real one. But I would think John would have more answers to that than I do because of his psychiatric training.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I think it's true. I mean, Henry Darger, for example, he started quite early. I mean, he began writing when he was 18 years old. The illustrations to the works came later. Many of them do start very late, and it's a question of opportunity. I mean, for some of these people, being locked up in a hospital was the first time that they actually had the time, and sometimes, with luck, the materials, to do things. And it opened up whole realms to them. I mean, Wolfley went from being a Swiss peasant who was thought to be illiterate to somebody whose own sense of his own stature was relatively on a par with Henry Kissinger. And, of course, he had renamed himself St. Adolf and signed himself from then on always St. Adolf. But only after he had accomplished the miracle of some 8,000 pages of writing and hundreds of magnificent illustrations. At the point that he had told the story of his journeys through the old universe and then through the new universe, he then renamed himself. And it was noticeable that he had changed as a human being and taken on immense stature. Lots of people, you know, are deprived of education, are deprived of a chance to even think of being an artist. And when they finally get to it, it's almost explosive.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Let's go to Worcester, Mass. Now, Susan's on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I am a professional that works with individuals with developmental disabilities and autism. And I think consider just the diagnosis of the artist or to use that as kind of a major consideration in whether or not art is considered inside or outsider is very narrow. The diagnosis does not define the total person. And just as art is not just a reflection of the mental state of the individual, I think we need to consider the spirit of the individual. And I think, our discussion about individuals with handicaps or mental illness is really also challenging the assumptions of our culture regarding individuals that have different learning skills.
Something that Roberta actually wrote specifically about, the questions of prejudices and assumptions in making those judgments, Roberta. So talk to Susan.
The other thing I think, I don't know if this is directly addresses what Susan says, but I would sort of continue her question to say that people like Wolfley and Martin Ramirez, another institutionalized, very, very great artist, I think, in some ways, they offer opportunities to study artists very closely. We don't study inside artists with quite the microscopes that could be applied to Wolfley. So in some ways, I don't think you can assume that their minds aren't similar, that they don't have similar psychic disturbances. It's just that we look much more closely at outsider.
Susan, when we look at the art of someone like Judith Scott, the middle-aged woman with Down syndrome who's, you know, making a lot of money mm-hmm. with her fiber art now, mm-hmm. are you saying that that we really need to take away from a consideration of her that she has a disability?
Yes, I think that, you know, again, this is challenging our culture's understanding of what disability is.
I get that completely, but what John was saying earlier and what I'd like to hear you speak a bit about is that when you evaluate her art, knowing, you know, the circumstances under which she works,
absolutely.
It becomes that much more compelling. You look
exactly.
at one of these twisted dolls on the floor and you think,
yes.
wow, how did it come from that woman's mind?
Absolutely, and I think it allows us to expand our understanding. So I do think it adds quite a bit. But again, not looking at it from a suffering perspective. I mean, using the description of the individual suffering from Down syndrome, I think is making a lot of assumptions mm-hmm. about what is good and what is bad. Look at what she has been able to present and consider this art as a way of nonverbally communicating something of her spirit that perhaps more traditional forms of communication couldn't even come close to expressing.
And which is, John, I think what you were saying, is it not?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, what's happened with Judith is absolutely miraculous. I mean, this woman was institutionalized in literally a warehouse for generations. Her sister finally rescued her from this situation and brought her to California. And she has become a happy person. She loves what she's doing. She works terribly hard, but she obviously loves it. And the miracle is that she's reached out to the whole world with her art.
Connection listeners, we're going inside the outside art phenomenon this hour, wondering if the concept is outdated, still holds up in terms of defining the artists or the art. We'd like to hear from you. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR, and this hour I'm with Roberta Smith in New York and John McGregor in San Francisco. And listeners, we're talking about outsider art and asking whether or not it's a genre all of its own. Should it remain there? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll go straight back to the calls, and Rob's joining us now from Plymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Dick.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question about, is it possible for an insider to become an outsider? And I'm thinking specifically of my favorite artist, Vincent van Gogh. I am a psychologist, and my understanding about his mental illness towards the end of his life was that he was probably suffering from bipolar illness, and that he was quite tortured towards the end. And I wondered what your guests might be thinking about, or what they have comments about. What happened to him?
No, good question. Roberta, Van Gogh booked himself into St. Remy Asylum for, what, the last 10 years of his life and continued to work there.
It was a shorter period than
that. Was it shorter? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that Van Gogh was a very disturbed insider, I guess I would say. I can't imagine that his... I mean, he was completely involved with the art of his time, with the newest ideas being explored in painting. He was, you know, he tried to work for a while alongside Gauguin, and so he was completely up to date. And his brother was an art dealer. It's hard to think of anybody who, in many ways, was much more connected. And he had severe mental problems, I think a lot of artists do. So I can't see him as an outsider. I do think that he was in touch with something profound within himself that was undoubtedly affected by his mental disturbances.
Is this part of what blurs the line then, Roberta?
Yeah, I think so.
John, let me hear from you.
Well, yes, it is possible for an insider to become an outsider if they develop very, very profound mental illness and continue painting. And there are some wonderful, wonderful cases where, as a result of severe illness, the artist changed altogether his style, everything changed, and produced work which I think is vastly superior to what was done before. However, Vincent van Gogh is not an example of this. Vincent had seizures, and they were massive. And when they occurred, he literally became raving mad and rolling on the ground for a period of a couple of weeks. During that time, he never painted. There were a couple of occasions when he tried to go on painting as the seizure was coming on, and he could sometimes tell. And as far as I can see, the effect was bad on the painting. It damaged the painting. So I don't think he is an example in any sense at all of the outsider artist. Not to say that the later work, in some ways you can see the influence of the experience he's had, but not at the time. He's not painting when he is mad.
Rob, back to you. Does it matter when you're looking at a piece of art what the state of mind of the artist is, or do you put that all aside and just evaluate what you're looking at?
Well, I think in particular with respect to Van Gogh, it does matter to me. I've been to several shows where, you know, there's this the progressive selection of pictures from beginning to the end of his career. And it is clear to me, at least, that towards the end of his career, the Starry Night, for example, is so different from his early works that are so much more representational of peasants in the potato field. And is that progression all because he's of his own insider connection to the art at that time, or did he at some point cross a line? But I will say that his later works are my favorite, and I think they're, you know, stunning, and he was certainly one of the great artists of all time.
So. All right, Rob, I'm glad you brought him up. He's a good example of trying to understand this. Let's go next to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Doug's on the line. Hi, Doug.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I just wanted to comment that I think I myself may qualify as outsider art. I spent 7 years in a mental hospital, and certainly that was the first place I tried dabbling with art, and as has been said, I had the time to be able to keep doing it. After those 7 years, I managed to get out, but no job was ever long-lasting because of continued mental problems, but the one thing that has kept me going is painting. So I would just comment that if there's anybody out there listening, just keep doing it. For me, it has been a lifesaver. Whether I get accepted or not, I've had some gallery gigs once in a while. I sell most of my stuff out of coffee shops. So.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do you sell a lot of your art?
I've managed to sell about one-third of what I painted.
And so, well, that's not a bad number.
Good.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking, Doug, is I'm curious to know when you hang the art, when you talk about it, do you say, well, I did this while I was in the mental hospital, or I mean, is that a part of what you're selling when you're selling the painting?
No, it hasn't been. Only one show ever, 2 years ago, did I put up a biography that mentioned my stay in mental hospitals. It's abstract expressionist work, so here in the South, it has a very small audience as it is. And I'm usually a little timid about trying to grow the audience via labeling myself an outsider.
All right, Doug, thanks for your call. Keep painting.
You're welcome.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Next to Charlotte, who's called in from Pepperell, Massachusetts. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello.
Thanks
How are
calling.
You all? Great topic. What I wanted to share with you was my experience as a teacher. I'm a painter, and I also teach painting. I teach college age and adult figure painting and still life painting. Every once in a while, I will get a student who has an unusual vision, an unusual way to draw. Now, these students generally want to learn the academic way to draw. And in the past, in my first few years of teaching, I attempted to teach them what they wanted to know. And I would have
Charlotte, I have a friend who's an artist, and he once said, pointed out to a child's drawing to me, and he said, that piece of work, that comes directly from the soul of that of that kid who was drawing it. It wasn't, how do I make a house, and where do I put the sun, and how big is the tree? And I'm wondering, in the children that you work with, how often you get that sort of purity of vision.
I don't have children. I have college age, young adults and then adults. I don't teach children.
Sorry, I misunderstood you. But of the ones that you teach, how often do you get that?
Not often, but maybe once every year I'll have a student. I have one right now in one of my classes, and she blows my mind. She does a portrait, and it's a genuine folk art drawing, the type that you see when you look at a folk art book. Very geometric, very simplified, much a portrait of the individual model, but in the artist's own way. And the point I wanted to make and why I called is, I don't try and teach these students anymore the academic way. What I do is I shift my discussions with them, my critiques with them, in terms of their color, their design, color and value, so more formal issues, and I let them be the way they are.
And John, I wonder if in looking at the really top-notch art, it often comes from people who have that kind of that quality of unique vision that almost doesn't need formal training.
Well, sure, that's what art's about, after all. It's about distortion. And the more distortion, often the more interesting it can be. Formal training, I don't think, really amounts to a great deal. I don't know very many highly professional, highly trained artists who don't insist that they're self-taught. And there's a lot of truth to that. You can't teach art.
Roberta, what do you think? I mean, some of the people who would be on the insider list would, I think, might argue with that and say, gosh, I did sculpting under so-and-so for 5 years and figure drawing, and it's made me the artist that I am today.
I tend to agree with John. I mean, I think that modern art is basically about overturning the academy and having artists get closer to things that aren't so, can't be measured by normal standards. And I most artists I know are self-taught or call themselves autodidacts. That's mm-hmm. another word. And I, spending some time in graduate schools as I do these days, I don't know what people are being taught there. So again, I think that's another indication of why the term is so slippery. The outsider term is so slippery.
Yeah, when I was thinking of what's in and out, I was thinking of all the Aboriginal art that I know, and I don't know if it's all naif art when you talk about Bill Reid and his cedar carving and some of the top-notch soapstone Inuit carving. And does any of that
fit, that's
Robert?
That's a tradition. I mean, those are artists who are working actually within their own community, who have certain traditions, who have certain kinds of stories that they want to tell, who look at each other's work. I mean, there are many, many art worlds within the art world, and that seems like a microcosm of a certain kind of art community with a style. Do you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it's a good explanation. I hadn't thought of that. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. One thing that you can both help me with here, and I think it's kind of a nice way of bringing it back to where we began with the definition, and that is why our notions of definition matter. I'll confess to looking for advice when it comes to judging art, whether it's from artists or writers or critics or other collectors, and so I'm drawn to think that it does matter to have some distinctions. But John, what's your answer to that? Whether it matters that we have this separate category of outsider art?
It doesn't matter for many people. I mean, in Ireland, for example, the Museum of Modern Art, they hang the works of outsiders completely intermixed with everybody else. No distinctions, no labeling. That's fine. There's no problem. But if you want to think about these things, and if you want to think about them in a fair amount of depth, then the distinctions become very, very clear. I don't think it matters what the name is. I mean, I don't really think the Fauves were delighted with the name they got saddled with. And it, once it's on, it's stuck. Mm-hmm. So you live with it. But the point is that the definition and clear thinking is important.
Roberta, what do you think? You were saying earlier.
Well, I would take issue with that, saying that I do want to think about it. And I just want to think about it differently than John McGregor. And I don't...
Be more precise. Tell me what the difference is.
I think that where this work comes from is very interesting and can be gone into, you know, and he has gone into it in the case of these of two or three artists more in more depth than just about anyone I know. But I don't think that those stories or the artist's own meanings are what makes the work compelling in a visual sense. Artists don't own the meaning of their work. You know, it speaks to viewers on all sorts of different levels. So I would say that people are not limited in their appreciation of the work because they don't, you know, haven't gone through all of Wolfley's texts. They have a different take on it, but they're still getting something that's very essential about it in its power.
John.
As a regular reader of Roberta, I think she thinks very deeply indeed, so I'm not concerned with that.
Well, you two have both opened up new ways of thinking and looking at this type of art. And I should mention before we go to our listeners that on our website at theconnection.org, you can see examples of the people that we've been talking about, Adolph Wolfley, Judith Scott, as well as others, and some other links that will help you and me with an understanding of outsider art. John McGregor, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
John's an art historian and author, most recently of Henry Darger, In the Realms of the Unreal. And Roberta Smith, thank you for your time.
Certainly.
Roberta's art critic for The New York Times. And earlier in the hour, we talked with Carrie Schuss, owner of KS Art in Manhattan. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Kuritsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Dania Akkad, Andrea Liebman, and Lisa Rufino. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.